another word on this outline or this listing. You'll have to bear of Concord. You are perhaps aware of the fact that you have to do with what is called, on the one hand, the epitome, and on the other hand, the thorough or solid declaration. And anybody who has looked at all into the formula of Concord realizes that the solid declaration is really solid in that it's not easy reading. They so studiously attempted to plug all loopholes that they just became very, very ponderous, you know. So much so that even at that time, the cry went up, for goodness sakes, give us a condensed version of this. And so then that was furnished, and that is the epitome. So that it all goes under the heading of Formula of Concord. And anything that you find in the epitome that settles a point, of course, is just as acceptable and valid as anything that you take from the thorough declaration. But you don't have the whole story when you only read the epitome. And so, in order to see how they really treated the thing to its last instance, in order to obviate any possibility that somebody could put a wrong construction upon a word or a sentence, you have that ponderous thing which we call the thorough declaration. And I think that, according to the old saying, that the proof of the pudding is the eating, you can't do better, you know, than simply to subject yourself to the task of plowing through the thorough declaration in order to really get the substance of that which we stand for, or which was done, submitted, in order to bring peace about in the Lutheran camp when it was torn asunder by all kinds of differing spirits after Luther's death. So bear in mind that you are rightfully referring to the formula of Concord when you refer to the epitome. You are also rightfully referring to it when you refer to the solid declaration. And if you compare, like, Article 1 of the Epitome with Article 1 of the Thorough Declaration, you will see on the surface that the Epitome simply is giving the substance of Article 1 in brief form. And that's what it intends to do. Now, I have these sheets, gentlemen, that I want to put into your hands today. A unit of mine in my syllabus on Article 7 and 8 of the Augsburg Confession and the Apology. But it is to show how these articles in the forepart of your Book of Concord have to do with Article 10 of the Formula of Concord, which bears upon what we call adiaphora. And it gave rise to what is called the adiaphoristic controversy, which is number one in the list that I gave you on this other handout sheet. When you all have a copy of this in your hand, of this outline in your hand, then you will have to bear in mind, on the one hand, that the numerals in parentheses on any of these outlines that I give you from my syllabus are a reference to Tappert, page reference to Tappert. The numerals that are outside of the brackets I mean, of the parentheses are references to the page in the Triglutta. So whoever is working with the Triglutta will disregard the parentheses so far as those numerals are concerned. Whoever is not working with the Triglutta will be concerned with the numerals within the parentheses and the other numeral there with the signal before it. That indicates what we will call sections. If you're familiar with your Book of Concord, you know that it isn't divided up in paragraphs, but it's divided up in sections, so that sometimes a paragraph may have 2, 3, or 4 numerals within it, each of them being a section of that paragraph. And so, for handy reference, you use the numerals of the sections. And they happen in most instances, not in every instance, but they happen to coincide, whether it be in the Triglutta or it be in the form in the interpreter's edition. So that my purpose in having this in your hand is that if you want an all-around acquaintance with this matter, then it is good for you to know that this was raging rather fiercely back in the days of Luther. In other words, in the days of the Augsburg Confession and of the Apology. It all tied in, of course, with the whole matter of the doctrine of the Church. That's why this refers to Articles 7 and 8 of the Augsburg Confession and the Apology, you see. Now, in order to sort of bring this into focus again, I'll repeat a little of the historical material that I presented to you yesterday in leading up to this particular study on the adiaphoristic controversy. What we want to keep in mind is that you have this situation confronting you, that the Roman party had won in a hot battle over the Lutherans. Up until that time, all through Luther's life, it had been what we would call a Cold War. So that in reality, the whole church was sitting on a powder barrel, but the powder barrel didn't explode. It just kept on having severe tensions, but there was nothing like a hot war until after Luther's death. And then a hot war came into effect, and in that war, the Lutheran party lost. So, of course, now the trouble was compounded for the reason that they really had to ask themselves, now what do we do to live with our victors or our conquerors? And you see, reaching back now into the days of the Augsburg Confession and the Apology, this is one of the vital items that represented the disparagement between, or the disparity, I should say, between the Lutheran party and the Roman party, in that, according to Article 7 of the Augsburg Confession, the unity of the Church was in question. And it is very vital for our understanding of much of this that you read in this context for you to have as clear a picture about that situation as you possibly can, irrespective of the fact that we are now 50 years later than that which transpired according to the Augsburg Confession. Still, this is only a hangover from the former period where they were really at each other's throats on this matter of the unity of the Church. Now, in effect, the Church of Rome was telling the Lutheran party that they had broken with the Church. If you know Article 7, of the Augsburg Confession, you know that it begins with the words they teach, namely, our teachers teach that one holy church continues forever. Now, that wasn't just a sentence in order to have a start of a paragraph. That sentence had a point. In other words, they had been accused of having separated from the church. And that was a mean consideration for them. That was something that they had to take very seriously. And believe you me, they said to themselves, well, if that's the case, then we better be making sure that we are out of the church. And if we are, we better get back in. And so they studied. And the more they studied, the more they realized that there's something wrong. There's a fallacy in here somewhere. And the culmination of that study was the conviction that's not true. And the implications of this, gentlemen, is discernible. That is, you can sort of feel with your forefathers as you read your Augsburg Confession, knowing these facts. Of course, if you don't know these facts, then maybe some of these phrases don't mean anything to you. But when you know these facts, then you read Article 1 of the Augsburg Confession, and you find that it refers to the Nicene Creed. You read Article 3 of the Augsburg Confession, and you find that it refers to the Apostles' Creed. What are they saying by implication? We identify with the Ecumenical Church. We don't regard ourselves as being outside of the church. And so then in Article 7, the opening sentence, also they teach that one holy church continues forever. So that we are, as far as we're concerned, as far as our convictions go, we are in the church. And then we say, now, how do you preserve that unity? Or when do you break, destroy that unity? And that's as timely a question today as it was then. How do you maintain it? How do you destroy it? And the simple answer is, you maintain it by agreeing concerning the doctrine of the gospel and the proper administration of the sacraments. And not what they claim, that unless you agree in ceremonies, in rites, in liturgy, let us say, in all respects, that doesn't actually make the difference. The difference is whether you agree concerning the doctrine of the gospel and the administration of the sacraments. And then comes this point, and now that's what is embodied here in order for you to understand what was basic so far as the adiaphoric controversy was concerned, namely that then already, according to these quotes that you have referred to on this outline sheet, they said back then, rites and ceremonies in and of themselves are not the worship of God. And, of course, that's what makes them adiaphora, you see. In other words, you can be without them, and you can have them. But in either event, it has nothing to do with the question, are you in the church or out of the church? Are you supporting the unity of the church, or are you destroying the unity of the church? It has nothing to do with adiaphora, or with rites and ceremonies. So then that was an issue, mind you, back in the days of Luther. And the Lutheran Party very articulately stated why it was not being bowled over by the accusation that Rome was hurling at it, that it had broken with the church. In other words, they repudiated that solidly. And also by implication, if you please, if you will follow me in my reference to the Nicene Creed in Article 1 and the Apostles' Creed in Article 3. They certainly were telling Rome, don't let us think for a minute that we have broken with the church. Or in other words, that we went out on a limb and the limb broke. Well, of course, that, as far as the Lutherans and the Romanists were concerned, was one of those things that just simply hung in the air, see? In other words, the Romanists accused the Lutherans of having broken with the church, and I don't suppose they changed their mind. But the Lutherans had studied the matter, and they had come to the conscientious conviction that's not true, and so we're not going to lose any sleep over it. And that situation went on and on and on and on and on, and of course you have the documentation in the apology. That's where much of this is taken from, you see. As to the arguments that the Lutheran party used in defense of itself and in repudiation of the claim that they had broken with the church. But then time went on, you see, and practically the only thing that was in existence was the fact that the one side said this and the other side said that, and that's where the thing rested, because, as I said, there was no hot war. There was nothing to give any one side the upper hand. Then comes the war. Then comes the loss of the war. And Rome is on top. And the Lutheran party is the vanquished. Now, how do you live with your conqueror? Oh, Melanchthon says, I've got that figured out. Now go back to this adiaphoristic thing. Now go back to rites and ceremonies. That's a good starting point. After all, these are adiaphora. They're neither commanded nor forbidden. And so there we can afford to please them. We can afford to give in to them because it's really not sinning. And so then that proposal arose within the Lutheran camp. Mind you, now we are in the period 50 years later, after Luther's death, after hell had broken loose, as I told you yesterday, and after they were in a bad, bad way, among themselves and, of course, also over against the Romanists. And when that came up then among the Lutherans, they looked at that very, very squarely. And the upshot of that careful scrutiny is what you have compacted together in Article 10 of the Formula of Concord. So you have to disregard the place which the article has in the Formula of Concord if you're thinking historically or chronologically. If you're thinking historically, you have to put the substance of Article 10 in the number one spot, and that's what you have on this outline sheet that I gave you. So you're actually concerned now with Article 10, but you are considering the first outburst, or the first effort, let me say, that was made in order to come to some terms with the Romanists, who through all of those years had held fast to their conviction that the Lutherans had broken with the church on account of their refusal to cooperate in rites and ceremonies. And I try then in this outline to show you, and I say then, at the top of the outline, this outline is a guide to that phase of this study, namely the study on the doctrine of the church, or Article 7, which shows how Article 10 of the Formula of Concord relates to this unit. That means to unit 5 of my syllabus, which has to do with the doctrine of the church. And it gives these data, but I'm giving it to you who are bent upon studying Article 10 of the Formula of Concord in order to show you how this reaches back into the Augsburg Confession and the Apology. It's merely to be of service to you so far as your all-around acquaintance with this matter is concerned, so that you don't isolate it and put it into the latter part of the century, but that you simply regard it as a thing that had been a bone of contention practically from the very beginning of the controversy between the Church of Rome and the Lutheran Party. So that I wanted to explain, that you can use that with that in mind. It's merely for the purpose of aiding you in gaining somewhat of a perspective concerning the ramifications of this whole matter. Now, as I look at the units that Dr. Huth has set up, on the one hand, I think it's unit 3 that simply indicates the historical background to the Formula of Concord. Well, I have practically furnished that in one lecture, see. So that everything else that follows in the wake of this is a part of the story, which in simple terms means that Luther held everything at bay as long as he lived, so that it was not possible for anything to break out which would become a disturbing element. You just can't quite imagine a man having such magnitude, you know. But that is and remains a stubborn fact. He just had them all held at bay. And he knew before he died, he knew that things were not as they should be. He knew that things were not as they should be even in Wittenberg, in the faculty of Wittenberg. And he tried his level best to smoke them out, but they wouldn't be smoked out, because they would not identify them, so they would not even let it be seen or known that they were secretly opposing the considered position of their party. But there were those who had their own thoughts about these matters. And of course, the proof of it is that as soon as Luther was dead, as I said to you yesterday, hell broke loose. And then it all came to the surface. And one after the other, these teachers with their ideas became problems. And this one, of course, was largely brought about by Melanchthon, the old peacemaker, you know, who thought, well, this is a bright idea, and this is a golden opportunity now to at least make some headway in this matter of getting together with our enemies. And it didn't work. So with that perspective, with that in mind, you would proceed now to look into Article 10, get familiar with it, both according to the text in the Epitome and according to the text in the Third Declaration. And it won't take you long to see how this does actually reach back into the same contest and struggle that was very hot back in the days of Luther and Melanchthon after the Augsburg Confession. And I think that you will find then, as you look into this, as you look into Article 10, and of course what we'll have to do is to leave the real nitty-gritty of this stuff to you in order for us to make some progress, so that all that I'm going to do is to give you some hints and some guidelines and some pointers with regard to maybe what you might be looking for But otherwise, it'll remain with you to go into the record itself, both on the basis of the epitome and the solid declaration, to find out exactly how this then was all articulated. You'll notice that you, if you look at the beginning of Article 10, I take it that most of you have Tappert here, don't you? I have that impression at least. But it begins like most of these articles in the Formula of Concord begin, by saying there has also been a controversy among some theologians of the Augsburg Confession. Now let's just take that sentence, that statement of fact, and dwell upon it in our mind for a moment, to this effect, that this certainly is a new era. Because that sentence could not have been put down, barring, of course, the fact that there were these hidden, like in the case of the sacramentarians, these hidden Calvinists, crypto-Calvinists. But I mean, otherwise, there was nothing on the scene that was suggesting that there were individuals in the Lutheran Party who were in disagreement with the general stance of the Lutherans. So that is a thing that you have to pinpoint in point of time after the middle of the century, around 55. That's when things began to happen. Luther died in 46. And so now we are reading, to our utter regret, that fine record of which we boast, so far as the Augsburg Confession, for instance, is concerned, we finally have to admit that there has been a controversy among some theologians of the Augsburg Confession. And in effect, that's the way the articles of the Formula of Concord begin. Simply hanging out the dirty wash that things had changed in the Lutheran camp, and they were squabbling among themselves. They had their factions, and some of them were very formidable factions that were becoming vocal, that were making their points and were insisting on being heard, and for that matter were in their own minds determined that they were going to win the battle. So that certainly history has repeated itself when you find Lutherans squabbling among Lutherans. This is not the first instance of that by any matter of means. And then as you go into that, what they were concerned with in the outset is, if you look at section 5, for the first paragraph simply shows what one side held as what the other side held in opposition. And then in section 5, you read, we should not consider, let's look at the negative approach, we should not consider as matters of indifference. That is what adiaphora means. Matters of indifference. In other words, God has neither commanded them nor has he forbidden them, so that actually it's almost a choice. But what we are doing here to begin is to make sure that not everything that you can throw up is a matter of indifference. And so they make very clear in this paragraph what is not to be classified under the heading of adiaphora, matters of indifference. That goes on through 6 and 7, because 7 says neither are, and so on. Then comes section 8. We believe, teach, and confess that true adiaphora,